So it is the 26th of October 2009. My name is Rohan Mukherjee and I'm with Kim Sedra, a senior researcher at the Cambodia Development Resource Institute. So Mr. Sedra, if I could just start by asking you to provide a little bit of background about yourself and your studies on Cambodia.
Yeah, I started my university in archaeology here in Cambodia. And in 1994, I got the East West Center Scholarship to further my study, graduate school in America in University of Hawaii in cultural anthropology. And then I returned in 96, and then in 98, I got the Fulbright Scholarship. And then I went first to Stanford and then moved to Northern Illinois for another master degree, because at that time, with the Fulbright money, you are not allowed to do a PhD. So I did more on economic and political anthropology over there in DeKalb, Illinois. And then I returned in 2001 and started with CDRI since then as a senior researcher in charge of governance. And in 2005, I got the Swedish government scholarship and to do my PhD in political science in Gothenburg University. And this is my educational background. And then on top of that, with my academic background, I've been kind of since 2000 or 2001, I've been extensively publishing many articles, including book, etc. And here in CDRI and also abroad. Yeah, that's it. And my main focus of research on is about the post-conflict reconstruction of Cambodia, the election, decentralization, deconcentration reforms, and governance at large. Yeah, that's it.
So could you talk a little bit about the reconstruction efforts, particularly state buildings, the construction of the administration post the UNTAC period?
Yeah, before I can say something about the post-UNTAC, I have to get a little bit of a historical backdrop. Cambodia is somehow kind of still sitting in the post-conflict stage because the problem of the post-conflict reconstruction of Cambodia related to three aspects. The first one about turbulence past. Because since early 70, Cambodia has gone through at least six major political regimes. It kind of a political interruption, a historical institutional interruption, all sort of things, in terms of ideology, in terms of leadership, etc. So this kind of institutional interruption makes the regime very difficult for the state institution in order to be responsive and accountable to its citizen. The second one is the political culture. As you know, that when we talk about culture, it's a complex paradigm, you know, it's very difficult to understand, and then each society has its own culture, etc. But Cambodia is still somehow kind of a embedded with the kind of a patron-client relationship, rent-seeking, neo-patrimonial system, etc., which you can see this everywhere in Southeast Asia. Yeah. And the third one is the nature of international intervention, which is linked directly to your question about the UNTAC, etc. I think the nature of international intervention in early 90s in Cambodia I would put it in a question mark. Somehow UNTAC was quite successful and somehow UNTAC was not really successful. Because the success story of the UNTAC is to introduce kind of a liberal democracy to Cambodia, organize the election, ending the civil war. However, it's a lot of chronic issues or disease still going on that UNTAC did not really make it to happen at the time. The first one is the UNTAC was not able to transfer the power to the elected political party. UNTAC was not able to disarm the Khmer Rouge. UNTAC was not able to establish a stable political and economic institution in the country. So you're ending up having the coalition government, you're ending up having the fighting with the Khmer Rouge all the way till 1998, after 5 years of the UNTAC. And then you see all the shaky political and economic institution in the country even right now. So these are the legacy, not a good legacy, but a bad legacy from the UNTAC. I would say that this is the nature of international intervention everywhere, not only in Cambodia, you see in Africa, in Asia, in the Middle East, etc. In Afghanistan right now, you see exactly the same thing happening. And after the UNTAC, I think Cambodia somehow, I see the way that Cambodia tried to re-establish or reinvent. I use the term reinvent. Cambodia reinvents its own state institution from scratch, basically. It's not only from scratch. You can build a house from scratch quite easily, but Cambodia need to renovate kind of an ancient ruin or temple, etc., which is very difficult. You have to fix. You cannot replace, actually. And that's why I see that the political institution in Cambodia is kind of a very complex. It's not to rebuild the new thing from scratch, but you have to fix, to treat, to cure the disease within the state institution, which is very difficult. The first one related to the experience that every Cambodian exposed to the rule of law, exposed to the notion of civil society, exposed to the notion of liberal democracy that the West and international communities try to import to this country, and then they want to see it to happen here. So it's not easy because people, the actors, are not really understood what is going on. You know, the lack of experience, etc. You look at the whole history of Cambodia. We don't have a strong, vibrant civil society, etc. While right now the neoliberal international institutions try to, okay, you talk about good governance, accountability, responsiveness, etc. And everything had to kind of learning by doing to make it short. Yeah. The second one is the human resource. I think it's very difficult for the country after the UNTAC period. Human resource, I think Cambodia, you see only 8 doctors in the whole country survive after the Khmer Rouge, 2 lawyers. So if you talk about Rwanda, it's just a kind of flash thing happening, you know, a couple months. But Cambodia been through the civil war for 30 years. It's not that easy. It's a chronic situation, if you like. And human resource is kind of the main problem in terms of, you can set up a very beautiful skeleton of state institution, but you can see something empty inside, you know, without human resource to make it kind of simple to understand. And I think the third one is kind of the geopolitics in the region. Yeah, Cambodia was kind of in the early 90s was very difficult to do things by itself because somehow you see geopolitics. You have the ASEAN, you have Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, etc. in the Western world. And you have Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia included, used to be kind of under the communist system. So it kind of you're changing the system from one ideology from the West, from the East to the West, you know? And it's not that easy. So I would say that these three problems are the dilemma that Cambodia is facing right now. And I think the way forward, I think right now I'm very optimistic that Cambodia will move ahead out of this post-conflict trap. If you read the report of the World Bank, you see 45% of the post-conflict societies 5 years after emerging out of the conflict, fall back into the civil war. But Cambodia is not. Of course, there were a little bit of hiccup in 1997. and now things move quite smoothly. Even see Cambodia right now, see Phnom Penh right now is quite different. I grew up in the Khmer Rouge. I grew up all the way in the 80s and see this kind of experience. Yeah, and the thing is Cambodia needed to, it's a lot to be done, you know, many to be done, like social issue, economic issue, political issue, rule of law especially. One of the most difficult thing among the post-conflict reconstruction is to restore the legal framework. You can write a very beautiful constitution, you can write very good law, etc. But you need internalization the law into the mind of people. Yeah. That's why the law enforcement in Cambodia is rather kind of weak because of it's kind of a low law enforcement. Because people don't understand. People are not used to that, you know. And it needs a lot of time to improve it. And the higher education, especially the elite, you have to restore the elite back, you know, real elite, not only economic elite, but you have to have a kind of a real elite, the bourgeoisie, the, if you like, in French, the middle class, you know, who have the education, who have the economic resource in order to survive, and who understand what is wrong, what is right. Cambodia needs quite a long way to go, yeah.
So you mentioned the human resource problem that the state faced in the early 90s. How was that overcome? How did the state attract human resources?
I think human resource does not really come straight from nowhere. It comes from two sources. First one is the state policy to liberalize, to open up the higher education, especially education at large. Yeah, you know, you see Cambodia, you can, many right now, I have the updated information, we have about 57 public and private institutions. Yeah, you're talking about higher education institutions. I think since early 90s, when the country exposed to international arena, so people pick up the language, people travel, and then Cambodian diaspora come back, and then kind of a chain of information, and then the flow of movement of people. So how education emerge. But right now, I'm not saying that we have good education. I think what the state needs to do right now is to improve the quality of education. Right now, we're talking about the quantity of it. You have many university, you have many students, etc. But what the heck if you don't have the quality? Yeah. And another thing is, as I said, the state is opening up the door, and then younger generation like my generation who grew up in the Khmer Rouge, etc., had the opportunity to expose, but only a handful of bourgeoisie in the city who exposed to opportunity, have the opportunity to go to university and then learning the language, English mainly, French, and get the scholarship and then go abroad and then bring back. Yeah, housing kind of spread out in terms of higher education.
And but was there, in terms of even staffing the civil service or government departments, there was a huge shortage of talented individuals to do that. Was there a concerted policy on the part of the government to attract individuals for that?
I think this has been, since 79, you know, the state, mainly the PRK, the People's Republic of Cambodia, and later on the Royal Government of Cambodia is trying their best actually to reestablish the state institution and then to gather, to mobilize qualified people to join the government. But you know what, after the UNTAC, the free market economy, everything based on the salary, you know, and then it's very hard right now. That's why the government cannot compete with the private sector and then the NGO, etc., because the low salary. saying, I think it, I would say there are a lot of educated Cambodians, they are having a good heart to contribute to join the government, but at least they have to think about their stomach first. They have to kind of strive for balance in terms of the salary and the income, you know. And that's why you see some Cambodian who, educated Cambodian people, they working in multiple jobs. Yeah, some join the government and also in the meantime they sneak out and do something else, like consultancy work, etc. So it's, but whatever. I'm quite optimistic that the government right now. I think all those. You see, the government kind of provides quite meager salary to its own public servant. They know that out of this salary, they cannot live on with that. That's why the government is very flexible right now. You know, you can call it tolerance. Yeah, its own tolerance to its own citizen, yeah, public servant. You work for a government, but you are not, you are free to do something else as long as you can manage your time. So that how things work quite well. It's not as based on like kind of a rational Weberian approach that you have to work for one institution. If you do something else, a conflict of interest, etc. But not like that, because you cannot provide sufficient salary yet for people to survive. So this thing works here.
Going back again to the period following the first election of 1993, what were the main state building priorities of the government at that time?
I think the main state building of the government at the time was security. The term peace or security means the absence of war, you know. Here is still positive peace, you know. They mean the end of conflict, basically. And then the second one is to reach, kind of, to have enough food for people to survive, not even poverty alleviation. Of course, everybody is in poverty in Cambodia mostly, let alone the elite. But and the third one is to reconciliate, even security, you know, to reconcile the wound, you know, to bring back all opposition groups together, yeah, as a one society. Yeah, that's what I see. That's why development is a bit slow, you know, since after the UNTAC, because you see, although a lot of the flooding of resources from international agencies to this small country, but why the output or outcome is quite low? Because the state does not have appropriate institution, effective institution to work effectively. Yeah, and most of the operation by international agency, they give funding, but they use by themselves. Yeah, so the money kind of boomerang somehow return. Yeah, yeah, and it's hard to blame, you know. Yeah, it with what I see, my over 10 years of experience of working here in Cambodia.
And moving to the post 97 period, after the sort of brief lapse of security in 97, it seems that from 97 onwards till the present day, the Cambodian government has been able to achieve quite a lot in terms of shoring up the institutions of the state. So did the priorities change after the fall of the Khmer Rouge?
I think in the beginning, I still remember everything. So from 79 on till 84, 85, it was Cambodia was struggling with the kind of a trap in the Stalinist communist system, you know, yeah, command, centralized economy, security was the main point, you know, at the border, conflict with the Khmer Rouge, etc. But after 85 on, it was kind of a incentive or ideas of the reform inside the CPP at that time, Cambodian People Party, the communist system. So they had to open up. they have to open the door in order to survive, you know. Yeah, they cannot afford to be under economic embargo from the West. But although Cambodia in the 80s was under economic embargo, but a lot of smuggling and leaking are along the border with Thailand, so it's still pretty much open. Yeah. And that why I see, personally, I see the Cambodian leaders since the 80s, they have had the ideas of free market economy all the way, at least from 85 on. Yeah. It started from inside the Communist Party.
And who are the individuals who propagated this idea?
I think somehow the current Prime Minister Hun Sen, I think he's the one who quite liberal and open since then, since he just started the Prime Minister in 85 on. I read a book by Evan Gottesman, and then I was a kind of a boy at the time at high school, you know. I still remember. I tried to, when I read the book, I tried to match with what my memory was from that time. And I see it's quite right. And then that's why I see Cambodia without this kind of political incentive or political will, international community cannot do anything, right? Yeah, it had to be a match between the two.
And for the Prime Minister, what do you think his vision for Cambodia was at the time when he started? What prompted this change in ideology towards more freedom?
I'm not sure about his mentality, his mind at the time, but personally I see that everybody, I think, who gone through the Khmer Rouge, who every Cambodian who kind of soak up with this kind of a civil war and conflicts, so they crave for something better. Yeah, regardless whether Prime Minister or Cambodian leader, they want to see the country moving forward. That's why the way out is to have an economic and political reform. That's it.
And did he rely on a team of reformers to help him implement his designs?
I think I don't know about this, but it must be a kind of a key persons in the party, etc., in the government, but I don't know who, but it must be, it cannot just one person, you know,
sure,
do that.
And so in the modern period, again coming back to sort of post 97, what have been the three main priorities of the government after 1997 in terms of, again, institutional development
in 1997
onwards? Yeah.
Onward, I think they put the poverty alleviation number one, and fighting corruption and governance number two, and human resource and education, etc. Yeah, service delivery also included. That's why I think since after the UNTAC onward, with the influence of international communities, Cambodia trying to kind of with the impose from the West, you know, they have to comply with a lot of the international norms, you know, good governance, transparency, poverty alleviation, service delivery, etc. So Cambodia is not unique, you know, we have to comply with these norms. Yeah.
You mentioned that there can be no real reform without political will. And I was wondering, even for someone like the Prime Minister who may have had the political will to reform, there must have been many other sections in the political circles who were opposed to reform. There must have been some vested interests in the system who were benefiting from bad governance in the past.
Mm. You know Caroline Hughes, right? And she wrote, and King was my buddy. They wrote the governance analysis in Cambodia, and then they picture these two white hat and black hat. And then they said that Cambodia is pretty much influenced by the black hat, because like you said, people benefit from this bad governance. I think this, of course, But you have to have a very strict rule of law and law enforcement. And then the thing is, if you look at every society that emerged out of the post-conflict, a lot of opportunists, especially the ones with power. Yeah. Even especially in Africa and other countries in the world. And that's why to get rid of these kind of opportunists, you have to have a very rationalized, stable state institution which is functioning properly in order to solve these problems. And Cambodia right now is working on this, and then I see that. But I'm not saying that we have a lot of opportunists right now. But the thing is, education I would be the ones. I think the younger generation equipped with education. They know that their parents are really doing the negative stuff, but they know, at least they know, and then they have to do something, you know. Education would be the way forward.
And one of the things that the government has done in the new millennium, at least, is to engage in decentralization in a big way. What is the objective behind that?
I'm been working. CDI is one of the leading research institute on this governance in general, and especially decentralization, which I've been kind of involved since 2002. Onward, and I think there's three objectives within decentralization. The first one is to have kind of a pluralist political system in place, kind of a participation, engagement, etc. The second one is to have kind of a poverty alleviation through service delivery. And the third one, to restore kind of the local democratic institution, because like I said in the very beginning, that Cambodia, the government does the own tax, etc., was not able to establish kind of a credible and reliable state institution. That's why right now the state had to kind of localize democracy down to the local level. Yeah. And how decentralization, but I see the there are many reforms, at least four major reforms in Cambodia: the judicial reform, military reform, administrative reform, and the public finance reform. The three major reforms, and D&D, decentralization, deconcentration, part of public administration reform. But after 7 and 8 years, decentralization doesn't. Kind of the achievement was to establish a local democratic state institutions in place. You have the commune election and council and the opposition, etc., sitting together and work, which is very interesting for the post-conflict society, where everybody just pointing the gun at each other, but right now they come and sit together. And second one is the state having a kind of a channel of institution to deliver some services, not much, but at least, yeah, a small scale infrastructure development down in a local area.
And normally when decentralization occurs, there is always a fear of from the national level that leaders at the subnational level might become too powerful, but at the same time it's important to, as you said, take development down to the local level. Mm-hmm. So has Cambodia faced that tension between?
Not yet. I would say I'm not sure that it might not happen, but it might happen too. The issue of decentralization, the elite capture, and it's not that easy, you know, when to take a power away from a small group of people. But right now we see a lot of problems still going on, but the state kind of responding nicely. We have a power and a line of accountability still based to the line agency, line ministry. you know. But right now they have the subnational government that, which is kind of try to harmonize, try to unify administration. Now they have the indirect election at the district level, which is above the commune, and then the provincial level to create a council, etc., and try to put all the services and power together. Yeah. And elite capture, I think nothing to be captured because no money, not much. We have about 15,000 US dollar per year for every commune on average from the state. So, and each commune doesn't have the power to generate its own revenue yet. So kind of absent of social contract. So it is, but I'm quite optimistic with decentralization. We can create a kind of a stable, reliable local institution. I think along the way will be very important.
So it seems so far that the main decentralization has been in terms of democracy, that elections have taken place. But financial and administrative decentralization is not.
No, you talk about two, theoretically. When we talk about decentralization, more or less we talk about devolution of power. This we have achieved quite successfully. No one can say no about this because we have a kind of a fair election and multi-party system in place, and then we created elected commune councils, 1,621 communes total in the country. The second one we have not achieved yet, but I think all the stakeholders involved trying, you know, poverty alleviation or economic or service delivery, yeah, not yet.
There is also an argument in a lot of the literature that comes up, which is that Cambodia has headed steadily towards a one-party dominant democracy, mm-hmm. And this in a way has been good for institutional development in Cambodia.
Strong state.
Yet, I mean, there are still questions about democratic viability of such a system going ahead. Mm-hmm. Do you see the tension coming up as you know?
I think one have to put this context into a regional context, a regional arena. When you talk about one party system, similar you talk about Asian style of democracy, Singaporean way, etc. I think look at all the Cambodia's neighbors. So we have all kind of a basically one party base. You know, look at Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, etc. Yeah, but I think if we think about short term, and nothing wrong, you know, to have one party as long as the state can deliver to the demand of people. So people don't care, you know, whether you have three parties, four parties, or 30 parties, as long as that the ruling party, whoever rules, have to deliver. And maybe from a democratic point of view, it's not good, right? But in particular for Cambodian and for this situation, Cambodian need an effective state. Personally, this is my personal view. You need a very responsible, very accountable and responsive state to deliver to the need of people. Yeah. But of course, Cambodia doesn't want to see the problem happening again. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think whether it's one party or two party, it doesn't matter as long as you have a very strong function of democracy, the system of democracy. Yeah. The election, transparency, accountability, distinguish what is the private and public domain clearly. The legitimacy is very important. Yeah. Yeah. If you have one party, but if you have a very effective election system, you can kick out the leader easily, you know. Yeah. In Cambodia, I think we don't need many parties and then somehow political situation here during the election is under our control. So I think I have to be careful about it as well. Yeah.
And you, on the issue of legitimacy, where do you think the Cambodian state derives its legitimacy from right now?
I think if you ask me the question 10 years ago, we were completely a big mess, you know, in terms of legitimacy. But after kind of 17 years of the international intervention after the UNTAC, legitimacy is kind of improving right now. And the state leaders are well aware lacking legitimacy, that why there are many elections and many kind of reform, etc. And legitimacy right now, somehow I see it's quite good. But if we talk, this is on in theory, you know, but in reality, Cambodian people don't understand much about the right of citizenship, right? You are the voter, and then what you should do with the voted. And but it's a long way. That's why you need a political education through decentralization, etc. You know, and then I see the Cambodian leader somehow very very good and smart in the same time, because they endorse decentralization and endorse other elections, etc. The right and indirect elections. But they have to work hard as well, you know. Although they are in power, but they have to work hard in order to be voted. Otherwise, yeah, I call it political education, you know. As time goes on, and then people start to aware that they are the power holder at the end of the day.
One problem that in studying various developing countries you come across is that of patronage. That in the appointment of or even in the distribution of important positions in government, you often find certain political factions have a claim. And this is something that we've seen in other countries, and Cambodia was witness to it in the 1990s when the two main political parties had a lot of new positions in civil service were created to satisfy that kind of a demand. Is that patronage system in any way reducing now in Cambodia as the state develops further, or is it still a problem?
I don't have an answer for this. I'm not saying it is declining or rising, but I rather see a patronage system here is more become a less kind of a visible. Yeah, in a way that the people, of course, you have a nepotism in every state institution, but they have to go through kind of a at least a professional layers. Like you have to have at least the level of education, at least you have to have a kind of a, some commitment, etc. Yeah, through political party or kinship, and in Cambodia, but I would see this is a patronage is quite. It's somehow you need this in a country absent of social safety net, absent of a welfare system. You know, somehow patronage and kinship and something you from India, you know that somehow you cannot rely on the state. But I think patronage will be less active when you have a reliable state institution can deliver, so people distance themselves. Yeah.
And lastly, well, since we're almost out of time.
Yeah, I have another conference at 1:00.
Sure. Okay. How important has been the role of donors in the entire process of development?
Yeah, in the development arena in Cambodia, I think you have to give some credit to the donor, because they've been kind of very active for the nation state building of Cambodia after the UNTAC. And I think the role of the donor right now, somehow I see a lot of donors still sitting in kind of a 93 or 94 kind of emergency stage. They should get out of that right now. They should look and then be able to integrate and to use the human resources in this country for Cambodia. But right now I see the kind of fraction among the donor. Each donor has its own agenda, you know, from Stockholm, Paris, New York, elsewhere. And that they need to harmonize themselves. They need a very good line of accountability themselves. And then and they need to be strategic. And then and based on what is the Cambodian context. And somehow I see a lot of donors, they are still operating as a in a global governance system, you know, instead of a Cambodia system. I'm not saying that they should somehow, you have to admit that the principle, universal principle like democracy, accountability, transparency, is a universal principles that you need to comply with. But somehow you have to be a little bit down to earth, you know, see maybe the context in Vietnam or Thailand different from Cambodia, and Cambodia different from other countries as well. You cannot, it's not written in stone, you know. Yeah, and this is the weak spot of the donor right now, and somehow they're that's why some donors fail, you know, to get the result out of this, the money spent.
Okay, well, to conclude, do you have any other thoughts on the things that we've spoken about?
No, and what I see, my last word, I see Cambodia is moving forward quite well. I think at least as other countries in the region, in Southeast Asia, and hopefully we in the future, if we have the society more developed, if we have a good human resource, and this country can move forward quite nicely. And then the way it manage natural resources and for the sustainable way, etc., and the political system have to be for the sake of the country instead of for the sake of a small group, I think it will be fine. Yeah, and quite positive. Yeah, for the future. That's it.
Thank you.
Yeah.